From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It began as Ronald Reagan's vision nearly two decades ago, strategic missile defense, part science fiction and part Cold War crowbar. Yesterday, President Bush announced that the Pentagon will field the first weapons in a scaled-down national anti-missile defense system by 2004, and instantly, the debate on the cost and possibility and wisdom of missile defense is back, too. It's a new world out there. Does that change anything? This hour, On Point, Star Wars for a new generation. We begin with a new study on executive pay. According to a New York Times survey of some 2,000 of America's biggest companies, corporate compensation committees, which determine CEO pay, are often comprised of the top exec's business partners, friends, and even family members. Diana Henriquez is a financial investigative reporter for the New York Times. I asked her about her findings.
We were looking at disclosure documents, the proxy statements as they're called, in which companies have to describe both the membership of their compensation committees and any dealings that members of those committees have had with the company itself or family connections that may exist. We relied in doing this on a marvelous database called the Corporate Library, which gave us the ability to search through almost 2,000 major companies and sift out the ones where these particular parameters, members of compensation committees who had some other connections with the company, were present.
Now, in this year of scandal, there's been a lot of attention paid to the super large employee compensation packages, but the response has been, this is the market. This is what the market is paying these people. What did you find about the independence of that dynamic?
It's obviously one thing to say that a CEO is overpaid, and we weren't trying to tackle that particular problem. Mm-hmm. What we were looking at is who decided what to pay him. As Nell Menno of the Corporate Library said, it's one thing to say he's overpaid, and it's a step further to say, and his business partner was on the committee that decided how much to pay him.
And you found in something like 400 out of those 2,000 cases, there were relationships between the chief executive and members of the compensation committee of the board of directors that might well have swayed their decision.
It's always hard to say, but yes, those numbers are correct. 420 of the 1,990 companies that we looked at had at least one person on their compensation committee who had a potential conflict. I underline potential because these directors tell us privately, you know, these ties aren't material. They're not enough to affect my judgment. I'm an independent, honest person, and I certainly wouldn't sell my reputation or integrity for this little bit of business or whatever it might be.
And yet these are sometimes family members and even more often people who have done or are continuing to do business with the company who benefit by the chief executive's good wishes.
Exactly. The family members were the biggest surprise to me. I just could not believe that in this day and age, at companies of this size, that you would ever find the CEO's father on the compensation committee, the CEO's sister on the compensation committee, or indeed even on the board of directors. The notion of a father still setting his son's allowance at this stage in his life was just baffling to me. But yes, you're right. Those were uncommon. Those were very rare. We actually listed every example that we found in that category, all nine of them. But the far more common circumstance was they do business with the company in some shape, form, or fashion. They're the company's biggest vendor of raw materials, or they provide health benefits counseling to the company, or they provide legal services to the company. And you're right, the CEO or people who report to the CEO get to decide who gets that business.
Diana Henriquez, give us a couple of the most interesting illustrations you found of big packages and suspect compensation committee memberships.
Well, I can't call them suspect. We carefully, you know, allowed folks to explain what they had to say.
All right, then, relationships that just don't look like fully
conflict.
Arm's length.
Yes, potential conflicts. Well, some of the ones we cited in the story we obviously thought were the most intriguing because of how very lopsided the compensation committees were in favor of those who did not seem truly independent. We looked, for example, at the A&P supermarket chain. That's a perfect example of a company that even under the proposals that are being made to try to address these independent issues would not be covered. They are exempt because they have one single large shareholder, the CEO's family, who owns about 56% of the stock. Now, the public shareholders own the rest of it, Nevertheless, on this compensation committee, two out of the three members were connected to the CEO's family. One is the family lawyer. The other works for the CEO's parents in their German interests.
Mm-hmm.
And they were establishing his compensation package.
So it's easy to see how this company that has a lot of public shareholders might compensate its executives in a matter that wasn't necessarily in the best interest of those public shareholders.
Well, yes, of course, the thing that you really want to know is how do you defend the package? The package may have been completely appropriate. Some consultants that we talked to, who we asked to look at the package, concluded that it was far more generous than it should have been under the circumstances. That's an expert's call, not mine. The question is, once you've made that decision, how could you defend it as truly being objective and appropriate when there are these relationships that hem around the committee? It's like having a record in sports where you've got to have an asterisk next to it. You know, sure, this is an appropriate pay package, but by the way, it was reached by a committee that had two out of its three members doing business with the CEO's family.
I was struck by the Clear Channel communications story here. You had only one out of five people on the compensation committee free of potential conflicts, and the compensation package included a guarantee, a severance agreement, that if one of the two sons of the current chairman was not selected to succeed him, they would, as I read it, both be eligible to receive 14 years of salary, bonuses, benefits, stock options, even when they were not at the company.
Yes, that was pretty remarkable.
That's what I call eye-popping.
It was strange. And, of course, that was one of the most lopsided committees we found, four out of five. And it used to be a six-member committee. The sixth member used to be the CEO himself.
Diana Henriquez, are there proposals afoot to try and bring more arm's-length relationship to compensation committees and the executives that they compensate?
There are, and they deserve careful watching by the public as they unfold. The New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ markets have asked the SEC to approve new listing standards for them that would require that any company that wanted to be listed on the big board or on NASDAQ would have to comply with new rules that would require a fully independent compensation committee.
And is it your sense that this might be part of a dynamic of reining in compensation that by any measure has grown enormously large in the last decade?
When a board has a compensation committee that isn't strong and fully independent, that's kind of a red flag that whole board may not be strong enough and independent enough to stand up to a forceful management and look out for the interest of shareholders on many topics, not just on compensation. So, yes, it is an effort to give the shareholder a stronger voice in how compensation is awarded and make sure that the people who make those decisions are independent of any personal vested interest that might conflict with shareholders. But it's also a way to try to push boards to think about their overall independence, their overall strength, the ability to stand up to a strong, charismatic CEO and say, we're looking over your shoulder.
To ask whether they're really minding the store.
Exactly.
Diana Henriquez, terrific story. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Diana Henriquez is a financial investigative reporter for the New York Times. President Bush is careful not to boast about the capability of the National Missile Defense System now being tested and scheduled for initial rollout in 2004. It will be modest to begin with, just 10 hit-to-kill missiles deployed in Alaskan silos. But will it work? And if it does, are we, is the world strategically better off or not? 20 years ago, Star Wars met a wave of criticism that cooled its jets. In a world of terrorists, suitcase bombs, and North Korean missiles, does missile defense make more sense today or less? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is George Lewis, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Good evening and welcome, George Lewis.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. And joining us from Washington is Lisbeth Gronlund, Senior Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Hello and welcome, Lisbeth Gronlund.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks for being with us tonight. George Lewis and Lisbeth Gronlund both contributed to a report in the current issue of Arms Control Today criticizing the Pentagon for technical failures in missile defense testing. George, I want to turn to you first. The Wall Street Journal editorialized today, thinking back on President Reagan's speech almost 20 years ago, where he laid out the vision of a Star Wars program. They said somewhere the Gipper is smiling, and they concluded with this thought: America's leaders will finally be able to do more than watch in horror if a missile is launched against the U.S. homeland. Are you confident that in 2004, when this goes into effect, and no one's saying it covers the entire nation at first, but it's to cover a portion of the nation, will the U.S., will Washington be effectively able to do something more than watch in horror as a missile, let's say a nuclear-tipped missile, comes toward the U.S. homeland?
I think in 2004, no one is expecting that there's really going to be much capability. Even the people in favor of deploying it admit that this will be rudimentary in the beginning, but they argue it will be built up to gain more capability. I think it's the problem with this decision is that it's premature. We just don't know if this technology is going to work in the real world. It'll certainly work on the test range, and we may be going down a technological dead end. Now, it's important to consider when you ask, can you stop a nuclear missile coming in, to ask...
This is the hit a bullet with a bullet, the hit-to-kill kind of dynamic.
Right. And I should be clear, hitting a bullet with a bullet, we can do that. We did it almost 20 years ago. That's not the issue. The issue is, can you make the system work against an adversary who takes active steps to defeat it? In other words, can it work in the real world?
So describe a scenario for us against which this new system in 2004 is designed, however, in whatever rudimentary fashion to address. Let's say it's a missile coming from
North Korea. This is clearly an anti-North Korea system.
It's launched from North Korea. It goes into space.
Yes.
And at some point it is perceived as a missile en route to the United States. How is it perceived, and what's supposed to happen in this new system?
Well, what would happen is the missile would be launched. We have early warning satellites that would see it. Eventually, it would come within range of a radar that would track it. Mm-hmm. At that point, we'd know pretty well where it was going.
Is that radar going to pick it up when it's still ascending, it's still headed up, or when it's on its way down, when it's in space?
Depends on where the radar is. And right. There doesn't seem to be a lot of radar capability associated with what's been announced mm-hmm. so far.
Mm-hmm. Which would seem to be a weakness.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if I could just interject, this is not really a system. It's a few interceptors. It's missing the sensors. So it's not really a missile defense system. It's part of a missile defense system that they're going to deploy.
Despite the fact that that's a word that's being used. But I want to complete this picture of what's supposed to happen, if you'll bear with us, Elizabeth, just for a moment. So, George, we've got the missile launched from North Korea, hypothetically. It is picked up by sensors, if indeed they're there to pick it up. There are missiles in silos 100 miles southeast of Fairbanks. What happens?
Well, once the sensors have a track on the incoming warhead, they compute a predicted intercept point, and you mm-hmm. fire interceptors, mm-hmm. likely more than one interceptor.
To hit one missile.
To hit one. You don't want to take any chances. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In some situations, you can wait to see if the first one hits and then fire a second. Sometimes mm-hmm. you can't do that.
All right.
So you fire two mm-hmm. Or more. And this rocket heads out towards the target, and at the end, after all the rocket boosters have burned out, it releases this relatively small, 100-pound or so kill vehicle that then detects the target using basically a heat-detecting sensor mm-hmm. and maneuvers into a collision.
So that it actually collides and destroys the missile in space. Elizabeth Gronlund, will it work?
Well, there are several levels on which you want to think about that question. If the entire system that Clinton was proposing was deployed, which would include the sensors, radars, and additional space-based sensors, there's a fundamental question of would it work against an attacker that took minimal steps to confuse the system.
No decoys, et cetera.
Right. That's a question that George and I and nine other physicists looked at in detail a few years ago.
Elizabeth Gronlund, we've got to take a short break. We'll come back and get your conclusion. We want to hear that. We're talking tonight about the resurrection of missile defense. Star Wars is back modestly in a new world. Are you relieved or outraged that we're back in the Star Wars conversation, that the U.S. is rolling ahead with missile defense? Were you opposed to a missile defense 20 years ago? Are you now in a changed world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the resurrection of missile defense. Here's an excerpt of the speech that started it all. In 1983, then-President Ronald Reagan laid out his vision for the Star Wars project.
Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? I call upon the scientific community in our country, those who gave us nuclear weapons, to turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace, to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete.
Ronald Reagan in a nationally televised address on March 23, 1983. We are talking tonight about the resurrection of missile defense. Star Wars is back modestly in a new world. What do you think? Were you opposed to missile defense 20 years ago, and are you now in a changed world? Does missile defense make sense when nukes can be delivered in a suitcase? And is the old Star Wars debate irrelevant if we're facing not the Soviet Union, but North Korea? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by George Lewis, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT, and from Washington, D.C., by Elizabeth Gronlund, Co-Director of the Global Security Program and Senior Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. They are co-authors of a report in this month's issue of Arms Control Today. And Elizabeth Gronlund, you were talking about the studies that you've done about the efficacy of the technology we've got here.
Right, and I was saying that even if the full system were deployed, there are big doubts about whether it would work. But this is not the full system. This is a small piece of the system. And this is a small piece of a system that has not finished its development testing. As George said earlier, it is extremely premature to make a decision to deploy. And if this were any other military system, it wouldn't happen.
So you say premature, you're talking technically premature?
Yes. Technically, operationally, mm-hmm. I mean, the technology has not been tested. Ordinarily, there's a law on the books, sort of a fly-before-you-buy law. Mm-hmm. You have to basically do realistic testing of military systems before you decide to deploy them.
So what's your interpretation of why this one is going ahead? Why?
I think there's no there, so I think it's for political reasons. I think Bush is trying to fulfill a campaign promise to deploy missile defenses by 2004.
And what's your strategic analysis of the impact of this, Elizabeth Gronlund? It was often said and feared 20 years ago when we faced a different kind of adversary, the Soviet Union, that this would be provocative. It clearly would have broken treaties we were in with the Soviet Union, but it would provoke the Soviet Union. It would actually diminish the chances of preventing nuclear war. It would make the world less safe. Is that still true today when it could be Iran, when it could be North Korea that we're facing instead of the Soviet Union?
Well, I think, first of all, the extent to which Russia and China react to this will depend on their assessment of its technical capabilities. And I hope they realize how very limited the technology is and there really is no need for them to overcompensate. I think there is no long-range missile threat currently from North Korea, Iran, or Iraq. If there is one that develops, the question is, you know, will it come with these countermeasures? And it, you know, by all, you know, logical argument, if those countries really want a long-range missile to attack the U.S., they would add to it these decoys.
That means the missile, once in space, would scatter all kinds of chaff around that would confuse the intercept.
Well, or they would, in addition to throwing out the warhead, they would throw out balloons, and the warhead itself might be in a balloon. So it would be impossible to distinguish one. You know, basically, it's not a question of using a bullet to hit a bullet. It's basically finding the right object to hit.
But in your analysis, has the situation strategically changed? Is it? They might develop decoys. They might not. Our technology might advance to be able to deal with those. It might not. But the underlying strategic situation, does missile defense constitute a provocation? Moscow said today they're afraid it will drive a new arms race. Or is this a necessary step in this new, more fractured world of security threats?
Well, I think what would be necessary, if the U.S. really is concerned about a missile threat from North Korea, it would be negotiating with North Korea. That is the best earliest possible solution to a potential problem that does not yet exist. Even the Pentagon acknowledges that this system they're planning to deploy has very limited capability.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to bank on it, my goodness. At the same time, I think if this is where it stops, I don't think Russia and China will care. But this is not where they hope it will stop. And so, you know, the Russian and Chinese reaction in the longer run will depend on how far the U.S. tries to go.
Elizabeth Garland, George Lewis, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jack Spencer. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. He's a defense analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Good evening and welcome, Jack Spencer.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Jack Spencer, what's your interpretation of President Bush's announcement yesterday? Are we on the road to an effective missile defense program here? Is this driven first and foremost by security issues or by, theology? Is there a commitment that surpasses the issues? How do you read it?
I certainly was very happy to hear the announcement that we are moving forward to deployment. For too long, the country has, as a matter of policy, chosen vulnerability. We've made a virtue of vulnerability, and I think that is what has given rise to the proliferation problem that we face today. I believe that once we show the commitment to actually building missile defense, that will devalue those missiles to North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. Now, it's true that they have not evolved their missile programs to have ICBMs as of yet. Mm-hmm. However, we do see them moving further and further toward that. And in fact, some government documents, unclassified government documents, say that North Korea might be able to put a lightweight payload on U.S. soil right now. Now, they haven't tested it yet. I don't know. But what we do know is that they're moving in that direction.
But what's
let me just finish this
quick
point. So while the threat may be in its infancy or in the infancy stages right now, I would argue beyond infancy, though, teenage years, so is our response. So it's true. The missile defense that will be deployed in 2004 is not going to be a complete layered system that's going to be able to intercept, you know, the high tech and a lot of missiles. But it's a beginning. We've ended our vulnerability, and hopefully our defenses can stay up with the technology that the North Koreans may utilize, and I believe that we can do that.
So, Jack Spencer, what's your interpretation? Let's imagine, and we hate to imagine this, but imagine that negotiations don't work, they're not tried, or they simply don't succeed, that in a few years North Korea has both nuclear weapons and missiles. I guess they have missiles already that might hit the outermost islands of Alaska. But this new system, or at least these new missiles, are live in their silos in Alaska. How does it change the thinking in Pyongyang if at that time there's still only a moderate chance of a successful intercept? We're hearing numbers of success that are all over the lot, some not even 50-50. How does that change the strategic thinking of North Korean military planners?
Well, I think that they will think twice about even developing longer-range missiles once we develop that system. But let's say that we do get into a situation where a conflict were to break out on the peninsula and we were in a situation where we were being threatened by a missile. I think that the North Korean leaders may think, or I should say the leader, Kim Jong-il, will think twice about firing that missile, because we will respond to that. Whether the missile gets here or not, we'll respond. Now, whether we respond with a nuclear retaliation or some other means, you know, that we don't know how that would be, but hopefully by deploying a missile defense system, the North Koreans would think twice about firing that missile to begin with. And if they should fire it, well, maybe we would only have a 50% chance to intercept it. But isn't that better than nothing? And if we know that we can get half of them, why not shoot twice as many missiles? If we know that we can only hit the missile, you know, 30% of the time, why not triple the amount of missiles? When you look at what you're protecting, which is cities and thousands, if not millions of Americans, it's really a small investment. But this is about creating deterrence for this very hostile world that we live in today. It's much more difficult than deterrence was during the Cold War.
Elizabeth Garland, please respond.
Well, we have not ended our vulnerability. If we are vulnerable to North Korean attack, we haven't even scratched the surface of it, because this is not a system. It is just a few interceptors. If what I'm hearing is that this is about deterrence, we're going to put a few interceptors in Alaska, and that will deter, that will cause North Korea to think twice, whereas the overall U.S. military capability, nuclear and conventional, would not cause the North Koreans to think twice about launching an attack against the United States, it doesn't hold together for me.
Your group, I guess your co-director at the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Wright, has said that this is illusory, this is the emperor's new clothes all over again. But Jack Spencer's arguing, okay, these are baby steps, but you know, the longest journey begins with a single step and all that jazz. From a scientific perspective, Lisbeth, do you see the possibility somewhere in here that the generals in charge are talking about trial and fix? Is that a reasonable way, at the cost of however many billions, to go at this problem, or is this somehow perpetually an illusory promise of missile defense?
I don't know if it's perpetual, but the notion of trial and fix is not something that we apply to other military systems. You get to a point before you deploy.
That is wrong. That is precisely how we develop technologies, whether it's in the military or outside the military. You keep saying things that simply aren't true. You said that no other weapon system would be deployed unless, you know, it went through all these it showed that it worked 100% of the time. That's not true.
No,
we always deploy.
We
always deploy military systems that are just in the research and development phase when the threat warrants. We did it with JSTARS. We've done it with a Predator. We do it all the time when the threat dictates that we need to deploy a system that or a capability that we don't have to answer a threat that exists. We deploy systems without going through the full fly before you buy it. It sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
George Lewis, I want to bring you in here, if you let me, Jack Spencer. George, there's a history with missile defense of very heavy dispute of effectiveness, results being interpreted in vastly different ways. You've looked at how the Pentagon has been analyzing the early testing of this missile system and come up with some very different success rates from what the Pentagon's announcing. Can you explain that to us?
Well, I wouldn't make too much of the difference in success rates. I mean, what we found is that an argument was being made that the missile defense systems had a very high success rate in what's called the end game, the last phase of the
flight of the incoming missile.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we found that those claims were exaggerated because a number of intercept tests that were classified as never having reached the end game actually did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I don't think that's the real significant thing
here.
The significant thing here is the testing program, it has to do with the realism of the testing program. Now, admittedly, the testing program's in a very early state, and it's appropriate to test against very simple targets, targets that are not what you would face in the real world. What the problem is that we are taking from these very early simple tests the conclusion that the system can work before we get to the realistic test.
So you're raising this prospect that it might not work or might never work.
We don't know if we are going down a dead end or a route that works.
So does that mean, in your view, that we should stop research on this or that we should just do it in a more limited way that's not going to cost whatever it is, $8 billion a year?
No, what I'm saying is we are making a deployment decision way too early in the research process.
And that would be fine, except for that the threat is growing now, and we need to do something to end that absolute vulnerability. Now, I agree. We didn't end our vulnerability, and if that's what I said earlier, that's not what I meant. Mm-hmm. But we are no longer completely vulnerable. By making that decision to deploy, then that ends our absolute vulnerability. Maybe, you know, a missile can still get through, maybe it can't. But then we move forward from that, and that's what's important. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to remember about how technologies are developed. Think of all those old black and white pictures that we see of people learning to fly, the crazy guy with wings on his arms and crazy vehicles that go down hills. They didn't learn to fly overnight. Wilbur and Orville Wright was at the end of an evolutionary period of men learning how to fly.
And then we've got that, Jack Spencer. That. We see it, and we're trying to see the nimbus of strategic issues around this as well. Jack, Elizabeth, George, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Frank's calling from Northeast Pennsylvania. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and I hope I'm not too long-winded, but I have a comment. In the our local papers, the Erie Daily Times.
All right.
And there was an article today, and they were talking about the threat from North Korea and all the missiles and all the warheads and everything that are in the world. I believe if I'm putting the wrong name with the wrong argument, I apologize, but I believe Jack Set is the person that's the proponent of this system.
Yes, he is tonight.
And I agree 100% with Jack. I think we need to get started on it, and if there's bugs in it, we need to work it out. After 9/11, there are people in the world that want to kill us. I really hadn't thought much of it until I saw the number of missiles and the number of warheads. They're everywhere. I'm sure that with the right amount of money, someone can buy something, And I'm not that concerned with the North Koreans because I personally think that would be suicide for their whole country if they shot one from their country. But when there's people that are willing to commit suicide and they would shoot a missile from anywhere or bring one in a suitcase or do whatever they could to kill us, I think we need to do everything in our power to protect our people.
Frank, I can hear the fear and concern in your voice, but what about that suitcase problem? When the bomb can be delivered just as easily, maybe more easily, in a suitcase or in a roll-on, roll-off container than via missile, does that make this, firing at the wrong target?
Absolutely not. Who would have ever thought that airplanes were going to fly into the World Trade Center on September 11th?
So you're ready to be ready for everything. Elizabeth Grunlund, please respond to that if you would.
Well, it's we don't have infinite resources and infinite capabilities, and I do think this is a misapplication of our resources. There are far greater threats. Terrorists acquiring nuclear materials. There's a lot the U.S. could and should be doing on that we're not doing. The threat from terrorists will never be from long-range missiles. They are enormous. They are heavy. It's not something you can steal. It's not something that the launch location will always be detected. So it's not something a terrorist group will get from a country. So that is not a realistic concern for terrorists. It will not be long-range missiles.
Well, I'd like to respond to that,
Jack Spencer.
Because two points that the caller brought up. One is, I don't think we do ourselves any justice by saying North Korea, North Korea, North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the country who is associated with the missile. It's the missile and the proliferation of the missile, that it's a valuable tool for states who want to challenge American power. So whether it's a North Korean missile or some other country with a missile, it's the missile we need to defend against, not necessarily a North Korean missile. Secondly, this argument that why would we shouldn't do missile defense because they can smuggle them in on a ship or
mm-hmm.
whatever. That's true. We need to address the smuggling issue, but we shouldn't leave we don't lock our back door and leave the front door open.
But is there a trade-off here? Are we giving up something for that $8 billion a year?
Absolutely. And remember that we see this missile proliferation occurring. It's not a theory. It's not right-wing, crazy political people wanting to spend money. We see the missile proliferation occurring. We didn't see people stealing airplanes, for example. But this is a threat that we see. We know it's out there, and we can address it, or at least we should make every attempt we can to address it. So we need to do the smuggling, but we also need to do the missile defense.
Elizabeth Grunlund, just 20 seconds before the break.
I agree. We do need to make every attempt we can, and that includes negotiating, which is a far more effective strategy than missile defense at this point.
And negotiation is part of the overall arms control effort. I'm not opposed to negotiation, but it's always this or that. We need to apply every tool we have.
Let's come back in a moment and talk about how those interact. We're talking about the resurrection of missile defense tonight. Star Wars is back modestly in a new world. If the technology is so unreliable, why are we pushing ahead? Is this real defense or Reagan theology? Has a nuclear axis of evil changed your mind about missile defense? Does all this pull us closer to war or to peace? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the resurrection of missile defense in America. Star Wars is back or coming. It's back modestly in a new world. Are you relieved or outraged that we're back in the Star Wars conversation, that the U.S. is rolling ahead with missile defense? And were you opposed to missile defense 20 years ago? Are you now in a changed world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are George Lewis from MIT, Elizabeth Grunlund from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Jack Spencer from the Heritage Foundation. You're welcome to join us as well at 1-800-423-TALK. Paul's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I've followed this debate since the early 80s, but I wanted to point out that offense is always going to be cheaper than defense on this, and that I have a modest proposal, and that we take a second group of scientists, give them 10% of the whole budget, and let them develop countermeasures. And then instead of having the fake kind of rigged tests that they've done so far, that the missile people try and shoot down these missiles that are equipped with the kind of most rudimentary countermeasures.
Oh, you're saying so have our own scientists try and develop decoys and see if our other team can defeat those decoys.
Give them 5 or 10%, and they'll never even get close to the the countermeasures.
And here's the argument that it can never be done. George Lewis, just how daunting is it to deal with the issue of decoys? A missile goes up from whatever origin. It gets into space. It blasts decoys out all over the place. What do we have to have? Missiles tipped with multiple intercepts that would go after 1,000 decoys? Can we distinguish the real nuclear missile tip from all the decoys out there?
Well, decoys can be difficult to deal with. The simplest way to deal with decoys is to have a lot of interceptors and fire at every one. That could be a solution if decoys were the only countermeasure.
Okay.
The problem is there's different countermeasures and they require different responses. And trying to deal with them all becomes very cumbersome. And it might be useful, I think, to put in perspective that this defense has to be very effective. Because you talk about why North Korea would launch a missile. It's not like their leader gets up one morning and says, time to attack the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It would arise out of a confrontation with the United States. And the role, and these missiles are often said to give the U.S., defenses are often said they would give the U.S. freedom of action.
Mm-hmm.
But put another way, what they do is they allow the U.S. to take actions that we think might cause someone to fire a nuclear missile at
mm-hmm.
us. And they have to be awfully effective to do that. You aren't going to have a president say, go ahead with an attack on North Korea if he's told there's a 20% chance the defense might fail and Los Angeles would be destroyed. It isn't going to happen. They have to be extremely effective, and I just don't see that level of effectiveness being achieved for a very long time, if ever.
Jack Spencer, this is an interesting issue that George Lewis raises, and it seems to be kind of joined at the hip with preemptive war that's presented by the Bush administration as a defensive system. But theoretically, wouldn't, if this could become effective, and George says, hey, that's awfully difficult, but if it could, wouldn't that guard the flanks of preemptive war? Kind of a U.S. position could develop that will hit you, but you can't hit us. Does that make armed conflict more likely because the U.S. becomes less vulnerable, if indeed it could work?
Well, I don't think the United States goes around the world getting in conflicts where it doesn't need to be getting into conflicts. If the United States needs to use armed force to protect an ally like South Korea or its interests somewhere, and armed force is the only way that we can do that, then certainly I would think we wouldn't want to have a huge gaping hole in our defenses that would prohibit us from acting in the manner that I think that we might deem necessary at any given time. But there's another point I need to make.
Mm-hmm.
We do have scientists doing exactly what that last caller said,
mm-hmm.
developing the decoys. We're not going into this blindfolded. They're taking on a very huge effort, and I think they're doing everything that would be reasonable to do, including developing countermeasures. They actually have teams of people who have simulated resources that a North Korean government or an Iraqi government might have and have them develop the countermeasures that they think that we would most likely face.
Elizabeth Grunlund, are you persuaded by those efforts?
Well, I do. There are some efforts, and we have advocated that there be more efforts, but the results of those efforts are not integrated into the test program. At this point, it's not clear when they will be, if ever.
We're early on in the test.
That's
everyone
the point.
That's
we're
right.
making
so
the deployment decision
exactly
when we're early
right.
on.
Right, but the threat is out there. We need to do something. Because both of you know.
But doing nothing is not something.
No. Look, the threat
is
North Korea.
And develop it into oblivion. By making this decision to deploy, we have something out there that we can build on. That's an important step in this. The missile defense debate is so politically hot. Both sides have a lot of history behind it, and it's really, we get away from the reasonable and rational in this debate. And I think I'm being absolutely reasonable and rational in acknowledging that history, but understanding that research and development has always been the tactic that the left, that critics of missile defense have used. They said, research and develop, just don't deploy. Yeah, we'll give you some money to research and develop it. But when it came time to deployment, then the research isn't there. The technology isn't there.
Elizabeth Grunlund, I want to put a question to you. Jack, we've got your point there. Elizabeth Grunlund, how is what's just been decided by the Bush administration different from what was in the works being planned by the Clinton administration?
Well, the Clinton administration had a whole architecture that they, you know, had they made a decision to go forward, they would have deployed also interceptors in Alaska and radars and whatnot, the whole nine yards. They concluded that they did not have the data to go ahead. So they decided we will not make a decision to deploy. And that is what Bush has now decided to do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We have enough information. We're going to deploy.
So trial
that's the
essential
defense. Now, I want to actually say that this is not the first time the U.S. has deployed a missile defense system. The U.S. deployed 100 nuclear-tipped interceptors in North Dakota back in 1975. Mm. It was also a system that was deployed for political reasons. And the day after it went online, the House voted to shut it down because it was agreed that it was ineffective. It was really pointless. It was a waste of money.
Elizabeth,
and
Jack, George, stand by. We've got more callers than I can possibly jam in, but let's try. Rob's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Fine, thanks.
I had a question. I guess it could be said that one of the strategies back in the 80s was to simply outspend the Soviets, and it could even be said that that was a pretty effective strategy. That wouldn't really come into play here, and I was curious how much that perhaps did come into play in the 80s and how it may make today's discussion somewhat irrelevant. When we start talking about suitcase bombs, as you were discussing earlier.
Well, Rob, thanks for your question. Jack, I guess I'll turn that one to you. Yes, part of the dynamic in the 80s was to kind of let the Soviet Union find the United States so daunting that it might as well give up the race. Can that work here?
That did work there.
Mm-hmm. Can it work in this environment?
Well, no, that's not really what we're trying to do here. We've identified a limited threat. The Soviet Union had literally 10,000 deliverable warheads, many of which were on ballistic missiles. And Reagan's Star Wars was meant to intercept each of those. But by the way, as that program developed, it became less of a the strategy was not to intercept all of them. It was to intercept about 1,000. But anyway, what we're trying to do now is to be able to intercept a very limited number of missiles that a country like a North Korea or some country with a limited number, tens or, you know, in the tens, less than 100 missiles, might have. So it's a totally different situation.
And a follow-on question there, if we can intercept a few missiles, is that not a goad to potential adversaries to build more? Moscow says this will lead to an arms race, to proliferation. What about it?
No, proliferation takes place with or without missile defenses. Russia has no interest in building missiles. We are great friends with Russia. In fact, I think that Russia and the United States will become great allies in this century. China began a nuclear missile modernization program when the Cold War fell. It looked at itself and reevaluated its place in the world and decided it was in its interest to go ahead and build more missiles. So they've been doing that independent of missile defense. And we see proliferation taking place in the absence of missile defense for years now. So it's not missile defense that causes proliferation. I would argue it's the lack of missile defense that gives value to those missiles that causes proliferation.
Elizabeth Granlund, we've just got a minute left. Give us your ultimate argument here. Why should this not go ahead, at least now in your view?
Well, it doesn't give us anything. At the same time, I think it takes away our incentive to do other things that really could potentially solve these problems, i.e., if there's really a threat from North Korea, we need to go talk to them about it. They're willing to talk to us, and we have not picked up on that offer. There are other things that we need to be doing to make sure nuclear materials don't get into the hands of terrorists. We're not doing those things. This is getting in the way. It's making people feel like there's a solution when this is not a solution.
Mm-hmm. So there is the argument, I think, pretty well illuminated tonight. Those who say we've got to have this to protect us from who knows what, and those who say if we have it, we'll be less likely to solve these problems in other ways. I want to thank all my guests tonight. George Lewis in the studio, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
George Lewis is Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Elizabeth Granlund, thanks so much for joining us from Washington.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Granlund is co-director of Global Security Programs and senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Jack Spencer at the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jack Spencer joined us from Washington. He's a defense analyst at the Heritage Foundation. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, unveiling 9 new designs for the World Trade Center. This is On Point. Nine new designs for the former World Trade Center site were unveiled today in New York City. Unlike the timid blueprints that were rejected over the summer, the new plans call for dramatic additions to the skyline. 4 of the plans include the construction of what would be the world's tallest structure. Independent journalist Alex Marshall was at the unveiling today. Marshall is a senior editor with the Regional Plan Association. In this radio diary, he shares his impressions of the new designs.
The plans presented today were wonderful. I mean, they were a much-needed start of showing what's possible on and around the World Trade Center site. They really showed how amazingly boring the conversation has been up till now. about what's possible on the site and around the site. All of them had some dramatic new element to the skyline. The Peterson team, they had two tall, thin towers that you could see from a distance. The team led by Rafael Vignole, they had the what I think of as the kind of square Eiffel towers with these kind of hollow structural steel framework elements that go soaring into the sky. I loved them. I thought they were great. What they called the younger team, so it's a group of young architects, had a city in the sky. It would be the largest building ever built. It would actually be a collection of three or four extremely tall buildings that would interconnect with each other. The team led by Richard Meyer and Peter Eisman had, I believe it was five very tall buildings that interconnected. So basically all of them gave the skyline a new monument in some way. Most of the architects integrated the memorial into their plans, which I think showed that it's such a central question that they had to. There was kind of the option of kind of leaving the memorial out and just saying, well, something will be built over there. But most of them did not do that. I think the tragedy that happened on the site sort of compelled everyone to deal with it. And so they all came up with interesting and different ideas of how to kind of memorialize that space. Daniel Lieberskin, he retained the what they call the slurry wall, the wall that kind of holds back the earth and the water, and that is sort of the only remaining part left now of the original World Trade Center. And he just said, well, you know, we're going to keep it. It's an amazing act of engineering, and we're just going to keep that. And so his plan would actually go sort of 10 stories down into the earth and have a plaza down there with a museum and a memorial, and then you'd kind of proceed from there to the uses of the building. Norman Foster, he had the spaces as a void. You know, other architects kind of built stuff on the site. They all pretty much dealt with it in some way, and mostly by integrating the memorial into their site plans. I like the best the most traditional plan, which was by the firm of Peterson Lindenberg, and they focused on much more traditional and perhaps boring stuff, which was laying out streets and plazas and public parks. It had a much finer scale than any of the others. They would actually put back all the old streets, which would actually create 17 square blocks. I think the danger of the really dramatic plans is that they look so good when you see these pretty models of them. But it's hard to remember that these things in real life would be so huge that it would be a very different reality on the ground. And I like Peterson's and Lindenberg's emphasis on streets, on squares, and on having a place for dramatic architecture, but that the dramatic architecture is embedded in a more traditional street plan.
Alex Marshall is an independent journalist living in New York City. He's the author of How Cities Work. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.